Chapter 96. Waving in her inflexibility, though at the price, I know, of tears downstairs. And see here. Here is Boythorn, heart of chivalry, breathing such ferocious vows as never were breathed on paper before, that if you don't go, and occupy his whole house, he having already turned out of it expressly for that purpose, by heaven and by earth he'll pull it down, and not leave one brick standing on another. And my guardian put a letter in my hand, without any ordinary beginning such as, "My dear Jarndyce," but rushing at once into the words, "I swear if Miss Summerson do not come down, and take possession of my house, which I vacate for her this day at 1 o'clock, p.m., and then with the utmost seriousness, and in the most emphatic terms, going on to make the extraordinary declaration he had quoted." We did not appreciate the writer the less for laughing heartily over it, and we settled that I should send him a letter of thanks on the morrow and accept his offer. It was a most agreeable one to me, for all the places I could have thought of, I should have liked to go to none so well as Chesney Wold. "Now, little housewife," said my guardian, looking at his watch, "I was strictly timed before I came upstairs, for you must not be tired too soon. And my time has waned away to the last minute. I have one other petition. Little Miss Flight, hearing a rumor that you were ill, made nothing of walking down here 20 miles, poor soul, in a pair of dancing shoes to Inkwer. It was heaven's mercy we were at home, or she would have walked back again. The old conspiracy to make me happy. Everybody seemed to be in it. Now, pet," said my guardian, "if it would not be irksome to you to admit the harmless little creature one afternoon before you save Boythorn's otherwise devoted house from demolition, I believe you would make her prouder and better pleased with herself than I, though my eminent name as Jarndyce, could do in a lifetime. I have no doubt he knew there would be something in the simple image of the poor afflicted creature that would fall like a gentle lesson on my mind at that time. I felt it as he spoke to me. I could not tell him heartily enough how ready I was to receive her. I had always pitied her, never so much as now. I had always been glad of my little power to soothe her under her calamity, but never, never half so glad before. We arranged a time for Miss Flight to come out by the coach and share my early dinner. When my guardian left me, I turned my face away upon my couch, and prayed to be forgiven if I, surrounded by such blessings, had magnified to myself the little trial that I had to undergo. The childish prayer of that old birthday, when I had aspired to be industrious, contented, and true-hearted, and to do good to someone, and win some love to myself, if I could, came back into my mind with a reproachful sense of all the happiness I had since enjoyed and all the affectionate hearts that had been turned towards me. If I were weak now, what had I profited by those mercies? I repeated the old childish prayer in its old childish words and found that its old peace had not departed from it. My guardian now came every day. In a week or so more I could walk about our rooms and hold long talks with Ada from behind the window curtain. Yet I never saw her, for I had not as yet the courage to look at the dear face, though I could have done so easily without her seeing me. On the appointed day Miss Flight arrived. The poor little creature ran into my room quite forgetful of her usual dignity, and crying from her very heart of hearts, "My dear Fitz Jarndyce," fell upon my neck, and kissed me 20 times. "Dear me," said she, putting her hand into her reticule, "I have nothing here but documents, my dear Fitz Jarndyce. I must borrow a pocket handkerchief." Charlie gave her one, and the good creature certainly made use of it, for she held it to her eyes with both hands and sat so, shedding tears for the next 10 minutes. "With pleasure, my dear Fitz Jarndyce," she was careful to explain. "Not the least pain. Pleasure to see you well again. Pleasure at having the honor of being admitted to see you. I am so much fonder of you, my love, than of the Chancellor. Though I do attend court regularly. By the by, my dear," mentioning pocket handkerchiefs, Miss Flight here looked at Charlie, who had been to meet her at the place where the coach stopped. Charlie glanced at me, and looked unwilling to pursue the suggestion. Very right, said Miss Flight, very correct. Truly, highly indiscreet of me to mention it, but my dear Miss Fitzjarndyce, I am afraid I am at times between ourselves. You wouldn't think it a little rambling, you know, said Miss Flight, touching her forehead. Nothing more. What were you going to tell me? Said I, smiling, for I saw she wanted to go on. You have roused my curiosity, and now you must gratify it. Miss Flight looked at Charlie for advice in this important crisis, who said, If you please, ma'am, you had better tell then, and there gratified Miss Flight beyond measure. So sagacious, our young friend, said she to me in her mysterious way. Diminutive. But very sagacious. Well, my dear, it's a pretty anecdote. Nothing more. Still I think it charming. Who should follow us down the road from the coach, my dear, but a poor person in a very ungenteel bonnet, Jenny, if you please, miss, said Charlie. Just so. Miss Flight acquiesced with the greatest suavity. Jenny. Yes. And what does she tell our young friend, but that there has been a lady with a veil inquiring at her cottage after my dear Fitzjarndyce's health, and taking a handkerchief away with her as a little keepsake, merely because it was my amiable Fitzjarndyce's. Now, you know, so very prepossessing in the lady with the veil. If you please, miss, said Charlie, to whom I looked in some astonishment. Jenny says that when her baby died, you left a handkerchief there, and that she put it away, and kept it with the baby's little things. I think, if you please, partly because it was yours, miss, and partly because it had covered the baby. Diminutive, whispered Miss Flight, making a variety of motions about her own forehead, to express intellect in Charlie. But exceedingly sagacious. And so dear. My love, she's clearer than any counsel I ever heard. Yes, Charlie, I returned. I remember it. Well? Well, miss, said Charlie, and that's the handkerchief the lady took. And Jenny wants you to know that she wouldn't have made away with it herself for a heap of money, but that the lady took it and left some money instead. Jenny don't know her at all, if you please, miss. Why, who can she be? Said one. My love, Miss Flight suggested, advancing her lips to my ear with her most mysterious look, in my opinion don't mention this to our diminutive friend, she's the Lord Chancellor's wife. He's married, you know. And I understand she leads him a terrible life. Throws his lordship's papers into the fire, my dear, if he won't pay the jeweler. I did not think very much about this lady then, for I had an impression that it might be catty. Besides, my attention was diverted by my visitor, who was cold after her ride and looked hungry, and who, our dinner being brought in, required some little assistance in arraying herself with great satisfaction in a pitiable old scarf and a much worn, and often mended pair of gloves, which she had brought down in a paper parcel. I had to preside, too, over the entertainment, consisting of a dish of fish, a roast fowl, a sweetbread, vegetables, pudding, and Madeira, and it was so pleasant to see how she enjoyed it, and with what state and ceremony she did honor to it, that I was soon thinking of nothing else. When we had finished, and had our little dessert before us, embellished by the hands of my dear, who would yield the superintendence of everything prepared for me to no one, Miss Flight was so very chatty and happy, that I thought I would lead her to her own history, as she was always pleased to talk about herself. I began by saying you have attended on the Lord Chancellor many years, Miss Flight? Oh, many, many, many years, my dear. But I expect a judgment. Shortly. There was an anxiety even in her hopefulness, that made me doubtful if I had done right in approaching the subject. I thought I would say no more about it. My father expected a judgment, said Miss Flight. My brother. My sister. They all expected a judgment. The same that I expect. They are all, yes. Dead, of course, my dear, said she. As I saw she would go on, I thought it best to try to be serviceable to her by meeting the theme, rather than avoiding it. Would it not be wiser, said I, to expect this judgment no more? Why, my dear, she answered promptly, of course it would. And to attend the court no more? Equally of course, said she. Very wearing to be always in expectation of what never comes, my dear Fitz Jarndyce. Wearing, I assure you, to the bone. She slightly showed me her arm, and it was fearfully thin indeed. But, my dear, she went on in her mysterious way, there's a dreadful attraction in the place. Hush! Don't mention it to our diminutive friend when she comes in. Or it may frighten her. With good reason. There's a cruel attraction in the place. You can't leave it. And you must expect. I tried to assure her that this was not so. She heard me patiently and smilingly, but was ready with her own answer. I. You think so, because I am a little rambling. Very absurd, to be a little rambling, is it not? Very confusing too. To the head. I find it so. But, my dear, I have been there many years, and I have noticed. It's the mace and seal upon the table. What could they do, did she think? I mildly asked her. Draw, returned Miss Flight. Draw people on, my dear. Draw peace out of them. Sense out of them. Good looks out of them. Good qualities out of them. I have felt them even drawing my rest away in the night. Cold and glittering devils. She tapped me several times upon the arm and nodded good-humoredly, as if she were anxious I should understand that I had no cause to fear her, though she spoke so gloomily, and confided these awful secrets to me. Let me see, said she. I'll tell you my own case. Before they ever drew me, before I had ever seen them, what was it I used to do? Tambourine playing? No. Tambour work. I and my sister worked at tambour work. Our father and our brother had a builder's business. We all lived together. Very respectably, my dear. First, our father was drawn slowly. Home was drawn with him. In a few years he was a fierce, sour, angry bankrupt without a kind word, or a kind look for anyone. He had been so different, Fitz Jarndyce. He was drawn to a debtor's prison. There he died. Then our brother was drawn swiftly to drunkenness, and rags, and death. Then my sister was drawn. Hush! Never asked to what. Then I was ill and in misery, and heard, as I had often heard before, that this was all the work of chancery. When I got better, I went to look at the monster. And then I found out how it was, and I was drawn to stay there. Having got over her own short narrative, in the delivery of which she had spoken in a low, strained voice, as if the shock were fresh upon her, she gradually resumed her usual air of amiable importance. You don't quite credit me, my dear. Well, you will, someday. I am a little rambling. But I have noticed. I have seen many new faces come, unsuspicious, within the influence of the mace, and seal in these many years. As my father's came there. As my brother's. As my sister's. As my own. I hear conversation Kenj and the rest of them say to the new faces, here's little Miss Flight. Oh, you are new here, and you must come, and be presented to little Miss Flight. Very good. Proud I am sure to have the honor. And we all laugh. But, Fitz Jarndyce, I know what will happen. I know, far better than they do, when the attraction has begun. I know the signs, my dear. I saw them begin in Gridley. And I saw them end. Fitz Jarndyce, my love, speaking low again, I saw them beginning in our friend the Warden Jarndyce. Let someone hold him back, or he'll be drawn to ruin. She looked at me in silence for some moments, with her face gradually softening into a smile. Seeming to fear that she had been too gloomy, and seeming also to lose the connection in her mind, she said politely as she sipped her glass of wine, yes, my dear, as I was saying, I expect a judgment shortly. Then I shall release my birds, you know, and confer estates. I was much impressed by her allusion to Richard, and by the sad meaning, so sadly illustrated in her poor pinched form, that made its way through all her incoherence. But happily for her, she was quite complacent again now, and beamed with nods and smiles. "But, my dear," she said, gaily, reaching another hand to put it upon mine, "you have not congratulated me on my physician. Positively not once, yet." I was obliged to confess that I did not quite know what she meant. "My physician, Mr. Woodcourt, my dear, who was so exceedingly attentive to me, though his services were rendered quite gratuitously, until the day of judgment. I mean the judgment that will dissolve the spell upon me of the mace and seal. Mr. Woodcourt is so far away now," said I, "that I thought the time for such congratulation was past, Miss Flight." "But, my child," she returned, "is it possible that you don't know what has happened?" "No," said one. "Not what everybody has been talking of, my beloved Fitz Jarndyce." "No," said one. "You forget how long I have been here." "True, my dear, for the moment true. I blame myself. But my memory has been drawn out of me, with everything else, by what I mentioned. Very strong influence, is it not? Well, my dear, there has been a terrible shipwreck over in those East Indian seas. Mr. Woodcourt shipwrecked." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.